Oscar pointed out that if they started canceling events in Ireland because of rain, there'd be none left to go to. The brave Irish turned up and stayed. By the time we had rented a four-wheel drive vehicle and made our way into the grounds, there must have been 3,000 people there. The place looked like Woodstock, except that everyone was in oilskins. The two stallions we'd start were in a truck on a nearby promontory, so we slogged our way up there. They were squeezed into a tiny van where they banged and kicked. Steam rolled from air vents set into the top. A young Irish fella, soaked to the skin, was in charge. We agreed not to unload the horses to show them the round pen. The return swim to the trailer would have been treacherous. This was going to be a once-only effort. When the time came, the round pen was a mud hole with me in the middle of it. In the absence of a lapel microphone, someone gave me a remote microphone the size of a cucumber. How to attach it to me so that I had both hands free was a problem. They took my coat and shirt off, taped the cucumber to my chest, then squeezed the water out of my clothes and allowed me to put them back on. The first stallion was sliding down the hill, towing the lad behind him like a dinghy behind a sailboat. The horse's neighbor in the trailer was screaming, and he was screaming back. When the stallion stepped into the round pen, his feet were sucked into mud a foot deep. He probably couldn't have run from me if he wanted to. I started my usual introduction. "Ladies and gentlemen." But with a fizz and a crackle, the cucumber died. By this time I was too drenched to care. I was just going to go on, try to rescue some sort of demonstration and get out of there. Hugh ran to the announcer's stand. Seconds later, I heard his voice come over the public address system loud and clear. "Monte Roberts' microphone has been droned out, so I'm going to take over. And I know he would have said something along the following lines. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Monte Roberts, and we're here today to..." Hugh McCusker was my voice that day. And he did fine. Perhaps the horses wanted out of the rain as much as we did. They were begging to join up with me. They seemed to understand how important it was that they cooperate. Together they were two of the best demonstrations of the language of Equus that I have ever undertaken. Afterward, Hugh McCusker and I headed straight for the nearest supply of best Irish malt whiskey. Chapter 8. When a racehorse's worst nightmare is a starting gate. I look back on my life and clearly see that certain events were more than just points on a calendar. Some actually changed the pattern of my life altogether. The first of these occurred in 1943 when my father killed the black man. My conversation with Brownie in 1948 also looms large. In 1956, I married Pat. And I now know how fortunate I was to find her. How essential is her support and tolerance for my shortcomings and maniacal approach to work. The births of our children, Debbie in 1957, Laurel in 1959, and Marty in 1961, also profoundly influenced my life. There's the Monty Roberts before 1989, when I spent my first week with the Queen and her family, and the Monty Roberts who came afterward. With horses, there was my life before and after Johnny Tivio. I've never gotten close to another horse with a brain like his. He trained me, not I him. My experience with a horse called Lomitas in 1991 must be counted as the most recent landmark event in my life. Owned by Walter J. Jacobs of Bremen, Germany, and placed in training there with the gifted Andreas Wohler, Lomitas was a good-looking chestnut colt that would race in the colors of Gestüt Fahrhof, the Jacobs stud farm. Lomitas' sire is Neninski, and his dam is La Colorada by Sarumu. By early 1990, Lomitas began to show potential by turning in speedy workout times, and by early that summer he looked to be a fine prospect. Lomitas won both of his starts in 1990, and that year was the highest-rated two-year-old in Germany. Gestüt Fahrhof was no stranger to top horses, but it's always an honor to have a champion two-year-old. The Kentucky Derby and other classic races for three-year-olds present themselves as exciting targets. This was the kind of horse Lomitas was. The first sign of trouble came in April 1991. Lomitas was prepped and ready for his debut as a three-year-old, but he initially balked at loading in the van to go to the race. At the track, there was a bigger problem, the starting gate. The horse repeatedly refused to go inside, threw his head up, sidestepped, and pulled back. Other horses and their jockeys were in their stalls awaiting Lomitas. No one likes this situation, least of all the jockeys, for whom sitting in the starting gate is always a nerve-wracking time. After close to 20 minutes of struggle, the race began and Lomitas won. But imagine the apprehension in the Gestüt Fahrhof camp when their champion came so close to being disqualified. After 2 weeks of more schooling and tests before race stewards, who warned that a similar episode would result in a life ban, Lomitas was entered in a race on a turf course in Cologne. Once more, it proved difficult to load him into the van. But what happened on the track that day defies belief. Lomitas was the last horse brought to the starting gate, and again he refused to enter. As they had on the previous occasion, the other horses stood and waited for 20 minutes while track officials literally wrestled with Lomitas. They put a hood on to blindfold him, they yanked his tail up over his back and even the jockey's shoulder. Perhaps they thought the tail was a lever they could use to pry him into the gate. A dozen men, some in front, some behind, alternately pulled and pushed the horse, trying to force him forward and into the gate. At that point, Lomitas became vicious, attacked the men, and caused injuries. He ended up lying on the ground, exhausted from the fight. The race finally started, but without Lomitas. He lay behind the starting gate like a fallen athlete, immobile on his side. Immediately after the race, the stewards carried through with their threat. The owners, the Jacobses, left the track in despair. Their young champion horse was not only a non-performer, but a convicted criminal who would never race again. By this time, I had a reputation for successfully treating remedial thoroughbred racehorses. Andreas Vohler, Lomitas' trainer, asked me if I would set the horse straight. So on June 12, 1991, I put my life aside and left for Germany. At the airport, I saw a young man in riding breeches, perhaps a Vohler stable hand sent to meet me. "Do you know Andreas Vohler?" I asked him. He smiled. "I am Andreas Vohler." We drove immediately to the Bremen race course, where Andreas and others leased facilities for training and stabling their strings of horses. There I met the superstar, Lomitas. When I entered his box stall, he turned his head to look at me. Out loud and full of awe, I said the single word, "Gorgeous." He was a registered thoroughbred stallion, 16 hands high, 1,150 pounds, chestnut in color. He had a white pastern on the off hind leg and a star between his eyes with an elongated strip that widened and ended between his nostrils. I could see every point of his skeletal frame hitting its mark. He had a near-perfect thoroughbred racehorse conformation. "Correct of limb in every way," I said. I walked over to where he was munching hay, standing against the back of his stall, and greeted him with a stroke on his neck. "Hello, Lomitas. You're a fine man, huh?" I proceeded to move my hands back along his body, and I felt that he wanted to move into my hands, away from the wall. I held out against the pressure, and he immediately kicked out behind. I logged this as a possible response to any number of things and continued making his acquaintance. He struck me as a breathtaking animal, with a look in his eye that spoke of very high intelligence. I had traveled a long way to be standing here, and suddenly I was pleased to have made the journey. My task was specific. Cure this horse of his starting gate terror. After discussing it on the phone beforehand, Andreas had constructed for our mission a solid wall permanent training gate, which was much safer than the conventional kind. I'd work with Lomitas in the center of a riding hall on the Bremen race course where the footing was secure and the facilities are first class. I'd need an assistant, someone who could speak English and who knew horses well. With remedial horses, the people are as important to the success of the project as the horse. Andreas introduced me to a young man by the name of Simon Stokes. Talented and courteous, Simon Stokes is a former champion jump jockey from Chichester whose nose had been broken many times from pushing fences over with his head. He also rode on the flat and helped Andreas train horses. After living in Germany for 11 years, he spoke fluent German. With Simon and Andreas, I had expert help. On June 13, I set about trying to get to know Lomitas a little better. I took him into the covered riding hall, a small track 200 yards in circumference and 16 feet wide. Standing there with him, I moved to the end of the rope and asked him to step toward me. He seemed reluctant to step into my space. I raised one arm sharply above my head, then the other. He didn't seem unduly alarmed, which told me that he had not been abused by punishments that come from a raised hand. I stood next to him and lifted my knee and leg under his keel. Again, there was no discernible tightening of the abdominal muscles, no sudden grunt or lifting of the thorax. Plainly, he had not been abused in that area either. Then I took a short length of rope and swung it near his head. He paused and looked at me, then moved sideways and paused again. In his own intelligent fashion, he was struggling to understand me, but his lack of panic told me he hadn't been whipped. Finally, I led him closer to the wall and placed my hands along his side, as if to hold him closer against the wall. Immediately, he kicked out and plunged forward, showing classic signs of claustrophobia. This much was clear. Although his relationship with humans was obviously a good one, he was prepared to blame us for placing him inside enclosed structures such as the starting gates and vans, and he was perfectly happy to express that discomfort to his handlers. As Lomita saw it, people were treating him unfairly. I stopped to allow the pair of us a breather. Looking at his fine build and marking the extraordinary intelligence in his eye, I thought, I am in the presence of greatness. I'd better do my job with patience, diligence, and competence. If I tested Lomitas for signs of abuse, it wasn't because I distrusted Andreas or Simon. I always accord my horses the respect of asking them to speak for themselves. I've been lied to by humans, but never by a horse. It's not within his scope. And unlike a green horse, one who is more like a blank slate, any horse ever handled by humans comes with stories, perhaps baggage, and sometimes terrible events etched on their psyches. Lomitas was telling me, I've been treated unfairly, and I fear it's going to get worse. When Andreas and Simon returned to the stable from their other duties, I was back near Lomitas's stall, leading him around. I asked, can we use a round pen or lunging ring somewhere nearby so I can work him? That might be difficult, said Andreas. I need to turn him loose, to let him go on his own and win his trust. I felt that if I could join up with Lomitas, he might accept the confined positions we asked him to walk into. Well, said Andreas after giving the matter some thought, there's a short jumping ring about 10 miles away, but we need to get him into a transport truck to take him there, which counts that out. No, I replied. Hang on, we can do the van, I'm sure we can. Andreas and Simon were both nervous about this, but clearly it had to be done. So they ordered a van. When it arrived, Andreas suggested backing the van into the barn. With a ramp in the center aisle, Lomitas would be less able to slip around the side. He's going to have to learn to enter the van like a gentleman one day, I replied. And we might as well start as we mean to go on. Let's deal with this in the middle of the yard and do it properly from the outset. With the van parked there, the ramp down and waiting, I attached a long lead rope to his halter, a come-along, and schooled him for about half an hour. During the schooling process, he was obedient, hard-working, and well-mannered. Until he showed me a problem, I was going to treat him like a normal horse, and that meant loading him into the van. I walked up the ramp, and he willingly followed me into the van. The instant he was inside, the helpers standing by ran to lift the ramp. No, I told them. Leave the ramp down. I'm going to walk him off and on several times. The Irish exercise riders who were there warned me, if you bring him off, you'll never get him back on again. Have a little faith, I suggested. I walked Lomitas off and on the van without incident 15 to 20 times before we closed it up and made our trip to the show jumping yard. The building offered good footing, but it was too big, 150 feet long and 100 feet wide. Ideally, I needed a 50-foot round pen. With jump poles and standards, I fashioned a round pen, built it, in fact, around Lomitas while he stood there watching me. Then I went to work. Free of any rope on his head, he went into flight immediately when I pressed him away from me. He cantered steadily around the perimeter with one ear already locked onto me. Within a minute or two, he understood what I was doing, and I began to observe some licking and chewing. He was such an intelligent horse that in less than 15 minutes he was in full conversation with me. I quickly had a good join-up. He trusted me. Now I wanted to take this trust a bit further. I dismantled the jump pole so that we now occupied the main arena. It took a few minutes. He ran away from me for a while and thought he was going to take charge, but as soon as I told him to go away, farther away, he was pressing to come back. I'd go anywhere in the building, and he was right there with me, his nose to my shoulder. When that happened, I felt confident we could work through the problems with the starting gate. Going home, he entered the van like an old horse who had never had a problem with vans. Back at the stables in Bremen, we put him away, fed him, and left him to have a good night's rest. On June 15, 1991, I started to work Lomitas in the permanent training gate. I was banking on his trust, on taking it one step at a time, and on creating within him a desire to enter the gate. Within a short period, he was going in and out with no problems. Later that morning, Simon put some tack on him and sat on his back while I led him in and out. We were able to close the gate behind him and initiate the process of letting him walk out in a very relaxed manner. This took us through the morning. In the afternoon, Andreas had invited the head starter from the Bremen race course to watch Lomitas walking in and out of the training gate. He spent about an hour with me that day and was impressed by what he saw. The starter would recommend that the stewards reassess the situation and give Lomitas another chance, if he could pass all the necessary tests. During the first test the next morning in proper racing gates at the Bremen race course, Lomitas was troubled and a bit difficult at times, but he was trying hard for me, and before the morning was over he was going in and out of the gates easily. The stewards then set up another test on June 18th. They would want to see Lomitas exhibit the same steady behavior, but this time with other horses in the starting gate. Lomitas passed that test with flying colors, but it was still not the way I wanted it. He was a little tentative entering and a little nervous while in there. Andreas wanted to run Lomitas at Bremen on June 23rd. The stewards, though, would require yet another test, and this time they would want him to be nearly perfect. Only then would they consider reinstating him. On the morning of June 20th, we all assembled in front of the Bremen grandstand. With three horses for company in the starting gate, Lomitas was close to perfect. The steward said they would reinstate the horse for one race and then reassess. They added a proviso that I come with him and that nobody from the track handle him. To avoid him standing in there for a long period, it was also suggested that Lomitas be the last horse to enter the starting gate. The morning of the race, I was tense. I felt the gaze of all 20,000 people in the stands. Lomitas had become something of a legend among German racing fans. A national hero with an immense following, he was the gifted horse who had fought with his trainers and refused to race. As I walked Lomitas around behind the starting gates, parents were holding little children over the fence and calling out, "Oh, Lomi, Lomi, Lomi!" We walked around behind those stalls for what seemed an interminable length of time. Finally, I realized that something was wrong. All the other horses in the race were gathered to one side of the track, and the jockeys were deep in conversation. Andreas was huddling with the head starter and other officials. Finally, Andreas came to me with the news that the jockeys would boycott the race unless Lomitas entered the gate first. They said they were tired of being put in the gates and waiting for Lomitas to have it out with the starting gate crew. I said it made no difference to me. I walked Lomitas right in. He was good as gold. As I stood there with him, thanking him for giving us a good result on this important occasion, a starting gate attendant opened the gate in front of us. Then, with me directly in Lomitas's path, He went around behind and closed the back gate. Normally, this is never done. I could have been severely trampled. Then it hit me. Perhaps the starting gate crew didn't want this to work. With their straps and ropes and blindfolds, they would brush Lomitas as they went behind him. Accidental or intentional, I can't say, but the horse never did misbehave. If they were surly then, the crew would have been more so later. The burden of the coverage in the sports pages that evening was that the German starting gate attendants had been put to shame by a Californian. Lomitas stood there calmly while they loaded the other horses. And in a delicious bit of irony, track officials had considerable difficulties with some of the other horses. Finally, all were loaded. Lomitas broke well. He stayed in third or fourth position for much of the race and, with his great talent, simply overwhelmed the field in the last quarter mile. It was an undiluted pleasure to see that horse take his rightful place in the winner's enclosure. This triumph was the first in a series of victories for Lomitas. Later that year, he'd be named Germany's champion 3-year-old and horse of the year. His earnings climbed to 1,600,000 Deutschmarks, 1.1 million U.S. dollars. Such an experience with a horse of this quality bonds man and beast in a way not easy to describe. In just a short time, I felt the same degree of love for Lomitas as I had for Johnny Tivio, Brownie, and Ginger. Lomitas finished his year with 3 Group 1 victories in succession, the highest-rated German racehorse in the history of the country. Andreas gave Lomitas an easy time through the winter of 1991 in order to prepare for the 1992 racing season. Hopes were high for another outstanding year, but then the story took a strange, dark twist. Lomitas was owned by Walter Jacobs, a man I came to know and admire, and one of the finest owners in the racing industry. In 1991, he was 84 years old, and his courage and determination would be tested as the Lomitas story unfolded. Early in 1992, before the racing season began, Mr. Jacobs received a blackmail letter demanding 400,000 Deutschmarks or Lomitas would be harmed or killed. He told me they were taking special precautions with security, and naturally he was concerned. It occurred to me that Mr. Jacobs might simply want to back away from the whole situation and retire Lomitas from racing. He was, however, determined to meet it head on. I went to Hamburg in June 1992 and watched Simon, who was now handling Lomitas in the starting gate. Lomitas had no problems and won the race. Everything seemed fine. But blackmail letters were still coming and still threatening harm to the horse if the extortionist wasn't paid. To signal his intent, the letter writer burned down a hay barn on the Gestüt Pfarrhof stud farm. Guards with dogs were deployed around the clock, and additional security was arranged. In late July 1992, Lomitas made the trip to Düsseldorf. He entered the gate without incident and ran in the race, but his performance was lackluster, and he finished fifth. He was clearly not himself, and a new letter from the blackmailer pointed to the reason. "We only gave him enough to make him sick," it read. This was simply a warning shot across the bow, to demonstrate that someone had access to the horse and the will to harm him. Now events took on a new momentum. Lomitas would go into hiding when he was well enough to travel. He'd be quarantined in England, then travel to the United States, where he would race in California. I was amazed at the strength and tenacity of Mr. Jacobs through all of this. Another owner might have hidden from the blackmailer, but Mr. Jacobs in essence said, "This man will not stop me from racing my horse if I want to race him." We had to wait 15 days before moving Lomitas because he became very ill. The letter indicated he had been given a heavy metals poison, which affected his liver and other vital organs. He was a cruel sight. The beautiful horse hung his head, and his eye was dull. He was turned in on himself, concentrating on the illness and the pain. We all felt great anger and incomprehension that anyone could be capable of doing this. Lomitas fought off the poison within 10 days. His head came up. He began to eat a little. A measure of interest returned to his expression. As quickly as possible, he was shipped in secret to Newmarket. Only an inner circle of high-ranking police officers, Lufthansa officials, and people in Mr. Jacobs' office knew of the plan. Simon had once ridden a horse called Pirelli, and that was the name we gave him. In England, we hid him in Susan Pigott's yard. During the 4-week quarantine period, Simon gradually put Lomitas back to work. In mid-September, he was placed in training with Ron McAnally at Santa Anita, California. Lomitas trained well through October and November and looked to be ready to start racing at Santa Anita after Christmas. But unexpectedly, in mid-December, Lomitas developed a quarter crack on the off forefoot. This was a blow to me, for Lomitas never had a foot problem the whole time he trained and raced in Germany. A patch was applied to the crack and training continued. Soon other cracks showed up, on a rear foot, then on the near forefoot. All this within a 3-week period. Ron McAnally knew of a good quarter crack specialist in New York by the name of Ian McKinley. He had him flown out and had a round table discussion at the track with the veterinarians and other farriers. McKinley asked, "What happened to this horse about 5 months ago?" At that moment, the connection became clear. "He was poisoned," I replied. McKinley showed me a band of disconnected footwall about half an inch wide right around all 4 feet on Lomitas. I hadn't made the connection until Ian asked the question. The band of tissue had darkened around the entire foot, and the foot had grown down. The separated area had been taxed, and the cracks resulted. McKinley used a substance called Equilox on each foot, whether it had cracks or not. He was strengthening the wall artificially by laying this space-age polymer over the top. We were then able to train Lomitas without further cracks developing, but it was February before he could race. In his first race, the horse who crossed the line before Lomitas had interfered with him, and Lomitas was named the winner. His next race was in April at Hollywood Park. Distracted just as the gates opened, he got off to a terrible start and began 9 lengths behind the leader. Even as the field turned for home, he was probably 12 to 15 lengths behind. Then he made a blinding run at the leaders. He ran the fastest last quarter ever undertaken at Hollywood Park. As far as we could tell, had he broken with the pack at the beginning, he would have been only 0.25 seconds off the world record for that distance. But his feet continued to plague him, and it was decided to retire him to stud. He left the United States in 1994 to stand at Gestüt Fahrhof for the breeding season of 1995. While his American initiative fell short of my goals, Lomitas earned approximately $100,000 and served notice that he was a formidable competitor on the American race scene. The German breeders have responded strongly to Lomitas as a breeding prospect, and he was booked to 60 mares in 1996 and 60 more in 1997. Like a true champion, he does this job well, too. He has a conception rate in the 90 percentile range. It'll be interesting to see if Lomitas can pass along his talents to the next generation. My hope is that his story is just beginning. As for the extortion attempt, no one was ever arrested, but the police did confront a likely suspect and the letter ceased. Plainly, horses and starting gates sometimes mix like oil and water, and if Lomitas presented a great challenge in that regard, so did a horse with the imposing name Prince of Darkness. In 1990, I was staying in an English country house. It was the dead of night, but sleep wouldn't come. Prince of Darkness was the source of my insomnia, and I couldn't stop thinking about him. Getting out of bed, I began to pace up and down the upstairs landing. What could I do with this horse? Where was the gap in my understanding of this big, highly charged animal? Then I heard footsteps. A door opened, and my host, Sir Mark Prescott, appeared, likewise in his robe. The two of us blinked at each other. "I'm sorry if I disturbed you," I said, "but I couldn't sleep. I can't seem to get my brain to stop working." Sympathizing, Sir Mark took up a position at the window, his face cast in moonlight. Suddenly his expression sharpened. "Well, I'll be," he muttered softly. "Come and see." I went and stood next to him. From the window, we could see over the sloping roof of the house to the stable yard. In the moonlight, we could clearly make out Prince of Darkness, his head appearing first at the window of his stall and then at the door as he walked around. He was as awake as we were. Sir Mark sighed. "There's three of us trying to work out what's wrong, then." Prince of Darkness had been trained by Sir Mark in Newmarket and was owned by Pin Oak Stables of Kentucky, along with English partners. He was a large-framed dark bay standing about 16.3 hands high, very muscular and long in the body. He must have weighed 1,400 pounds, but he was no big clod of a horse. He was bright in his eyes, with alert ears, well-balanced and well-proportioned. They called him Prince of Darkness because he had once killed a steer in the paddock, perhaps not viciously, but after rough play. He would have been like a cat playing with a mouse. This horse was on fire all the time, but nothing set him off more than starting gates. Starting gates weren't built for a horse his size. He was so long that his nose touched the front gate and his hindquarters pressed into the rear gate, and so broad that the rails touched him on either side. Typically, of horses who learned to hate starting gates, his first few entries had been trouble-free. Then one day they were loading him during a training session on the heath in Newmarket, and he failed to step in fully. An attendant slapped him on the outer thigh with his hand, and the horse kicked out, hitting the side of the starting gate. He subsequently developed a negative attitude toward all gates, while walking toward them, entering them, or standing inside. I had to come to England to work with him once already and thought the job had been done, but I wasn't back in California 3 days before I got a call from Sir Mark. I was disappointed, but I also stand behind my work and I returned immediately on a no-fee basis. What had happened was this. They'd apparently gone to the gates on the heath, and Prince of Darkness had been upset from the time he arrived. They got him in, but once there he had tried to kick the gate to pieces. Now he'd go nowhere near one. What had changed him so much? I'd had him going in and out of starting gates like a dream, and now the three of us, the horse, Sir Mark, and me, were bedeviled by it all and sleepless to boot. That night over dinner, I asked Sir Mark what it was like to transport Prince of Darkness in a van. The horse was no problem, he said, whether the stalls were narrow or wide. This was hard to believe, given what I had been through all that day in the starting gates. Sir Mark suggested that we book a van with adjustable partitions so I could see for myself. My plan was to load the horse and give him a wide stall while we drove slowly around. Then we'd narrow the partition and subsequently increase the van speed. I'd stand inside the van at the horse's head so I could both observe him and instruct the driver. The aim was to identify the source of the horse's deep-seated claustrophobia. We loaded Prince of Darkness and started a tour of Newmarket, driving slowly and making careful turns. He was completely at ease in his stall, so we stopped and narrowed the partition. Still, he seemed comfortable. When I asked the driver to increase his speed and make more aggressive turns, the engine note rose an octave. In front of me, Prince of Darkness seemed unconcerned. He braced himself against the corners and took no notice when any part of the van touched his body. Now we were sailing around the town. Anyone following us must have thought crooks had stolen the van as we squealed around corners and took roundabouts at stomach-turning speed. The horse and I were rolling around like a ship's cargo in a storm. Prince of Darkness was in the narrowest possible stall, and the driver was risking his license to give us all the ride of a lifetime. For all that, the horse didn't kick or lean, and offered not the slightest resistance or anger. A far cry from what I had seen the previous day in the starting gate. What distinguished the stall in the van, which he abided agreeably, and the starting gate, which he kicked to bits? Back at the yard, I stared hard at both of them. Where was this horse's fear coming from? Clearly it wasn't claustrophobia, because he had been content in the van. Something about the starting gate spooked him. But what? That night, after 3 days of futility, I wanted to quit and offer Sir Mark a refund, but those words just wouldn't come. All my life I had found ways to win, and I couldn't bear the thought of losing this contest. I decided to give it one more try. The following day was the toughest of them all, 9 demanding and dangerous hours. Geraldine Reese, a friend of Sir Mark's, came along and patiently watched the proceedings. As Prince of Darkness was led riderless into the starting gate, I stood in front of him, just as I had in the van. I wanted to observe every nuance of behavior as he went in. He walked in, crashing and banging. No sooner was he in than he lunged forward, charging from that gate as if men with lances were arranged along the sides and poking him. He had no concern for me being in his way at all and galloped right through me, knocking me to the ground. I stood up and wiped the dust off. This was a problem, because I needed to get even closer. The next time he blasted from the stall in a flurry, he knocked me down again, and still I was no wiser about his terror. This was no game for a man of my age and with part of his spinal column missing, but I was determined to go in yet a little closer. Once again he jumped forward and bowled me over, stepping on my legs, side, and ear. Then he ran to the end of my come-along, turned, and stood there looking at me from 20 feet away. I was hurting badly, but in a flash, it came to me. Though my brain was muddled by this time, I had noticed something. Just before he jumped up and ran over the top of me, Prince of Darkness had rolled his eye back to look at his off flank, and his attention seemed to be focused on the offside rail. I stood there, bruised, battered, with a trickle of blood running into my collar. But I had found the source of his fear. The rail itself, of course. A van has smooth sides, whereas starting gates have rails on each side. I could have kicked myself for not realizing sooner, but I felt a surge of excitement. After a few tests, I knew I was right. That evening, Sir Mark and I discussed the situation. With mounting anticipation, he phoned various racing officials to investigate the possibility of removing the rails from inside a given starting gate. No luck. Because of the way they're constructed, when you remove the rail from one horse's stall, you also remove it from the next. Early next morning, I outlined another idea. If we could create something similar to what a picador's horse wears in the bull ring, a drape made of heavy leather to go over his rear quarters, perhaps we could convince Prince of Darkness that he had enough protection from those evil rails. It was a wild thought, and I had grave doubts about its practicality. Many years beforehand, I had draped a leather cape over a horse's rear quarters and attached it to my western saddle. When I then asked the horse to make a sliding stop from extreme speed, it encouraged him to drop his hips. He had to in order to hold his rear feet in the ground and support the weight of the cape. If I could use something like this to protect Prince of Darkness's sides from those rails, he might accept the starting gate.
"What if we used carpet?" asked Geraldine Reese. "Yes."
We drove to Newmarket and bought a roll of remnant carpet. Then we went to Gibson's Saddlery, and I started to design the kind of thing I thought might work. The prototype, no more than carpet sewn onto both sides of a stable blanket, was finished in just a few hours, and we raced back to the stables to try it out. When I put the prince in the starting stalls with his special blanket on, I immediately knew we were on the right track. I gave Geraldine Reese a congratulatory pat on the back. "Look, he's still frightened and not very confident, but he's staying in there, isn't he?" It felt good to stand in front of that huge animal and know that I might at last stay on my feet. The more he rubbed against the sides of the stall, stepping backward and forward, the more Prince of Darkness realized that he had protection from the rails. He relaxed and calmed down. We were making progress. We raced back to Gibson's Saddlery, fearful that the shop would be closed. The next day was Good Friday, with the Easter holiday period to follow. But Gibson's staff were good enough to work that evening and the next morning to further develop the prototype. The blanket would fit only the horse's hindquarters and would be held in place by straps. A ring sewn onto the blanket near the tail offered a place where the rope could be fastened. The idea was that the horse would actually break from the stall and run out from under the blanket. The horse races on, the blanket stays behind. Saturday afternoon we tried it. We took Prince of Darkness, with other horses for company, to the starting gates. I did my routine of letting him break slowly, using the blanket for protection. He responded very well. We schooled him again the following day, and that evening I told Sir Mark, then in France on business, that I thought the horse would make a good start at Warwick on the following day. George Duffield, the jockey, was game to try this invention, but a little embarrassed.
"Carpet? He's wearing a carpet?"
"That's what it's made of, sure."
"Is it a pattern carpet or plain?"
"It has a slight pattern, I suppose you'd say."
Oh, no,
he groaned. Don't you like patterned carpet? He held his hands up in the air in mock surrender.
No, it's fine. I don't mind looking like an idiot. Maybe I ought to wear the same pattern, the same color. Let's go for it. Trade in the silks. Can we stop at the carpet store on the way and measure me up for a tufted Wilton?
I assured him that Prince of Darkness had to have his magic carpet or he would refuse to start. The head starter was similarly apprehensive about the blanket, but he had given Sir Mark permission to use this unconventional apparatus, and he couldn't back down now. When I put the contraption up behind George in the starting gate, it drew a lot of comments from the other jockeys. In truth, it was a touch ignoble to have someone holding on to the rear of your horse with a piece of rope when you were hoping to run a race in a few seconds' time. I hoped the invention would work the first time. Inventions seldom do. Now they were under starter's orders. I dug my heel in, grasped the rope firmly, ready to take the strain as Prince of Darkness left the stall.
"End that off!" the announcer called.
There was a terrific kick on the rope, and then it went dead as Prince of Darkness broke from underneath his blanket with perfect timing. The carpet lay there on the bottom of the gate. Success. There were 18 horses in the race, and at Warwick they run about 7 furlongs and make a hard left. When they made the turn, Prince of Darkness was the clear leader. He didn't win that day, but he made the best start, and he went on to be a winner. Since that time, Gibson Saddlery has gone on to make many more blankets like the one the Prince of Darkness wore. On thoroughbred racetracks all over the world, they call horses who need the security of such a device blanket horses, and more than 1,000 such horses have used it successfully. I'll take some credit for the invention, but it was Prince of Darkness who made me see the light. To understand how Greg Ward became the best breeder and trainer of cow horses in North America, you must know something of his first horse, a fat little creature called Blackie. He was bought for $350, saddle included. When I met Greg and heard the story, I thought the saddle was worth more than the horse. Greg was born in 1935, the same year I was, in Bakersfield, California, and we were to become good friends. He seemed destined for a brilliant career in sports, but at the age of 17, those dreams ended. To earn money to buy a horse, Greg was on a neighbor's farm driving a tractor when it rolled on a hillside. Metal driven into his head left him unconscious and blind. After numerous operations, one to insert a plate in his head, his sight returned. But his peripheral vision was all but gone, and with it, his future in athletics. His parents later helped him to buy his first horse, the 8-year-old Blackie. When Greg went to California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo, he took Blackie with him. Ahead of me by 2 years, he had been asking questions and watching riders in competition, all in an attempt to make the college rodeo team. He did make it, and contributed to national championships we won in 1958 and 1959. I recall watching Greg ride Blackie and thinking, why is he wasting his time? What will that horse ever be? I was young, wore championship buckles, and had no time for an ordinary horse like Blackie. I now realize how wrong, how pompous I was to laugh at that horse. Blackie gave Greg everything he had and forgave him his mistakes. A classier, more sensitive horse might have been less sympathetic to him. Blackie, it turns out, mattered a great deal to the Western horse industry, because he was teaching one of the greatest horsemen who ever lived. I should have known better about Blackie, because my brownie had been important to me. Greg later bought 43 acres near Tulare, California, where he built the training establishment he still owns. It now includes 2 covered arenas and a half-mile track. Horses trained at the Ward Ranch, either by Greg or his son John, have for the past 30 or more years amassed an enviable record. Their horses have won 12 world championships in cutting and reined cow horse events, along with millions of dollars in prize money. Young horses bred on the Ward Ranch, including Dual Pep, the most popular stallion in their industry, have sold for millions of dollars and won that amount in the show ring. Valued at $2 million, Dual Pep has won more than $300,000 in prize money and has a breeding income of $500,000 per year. Where cow horses are concerned, the Ward Ranch is the class of the continent. Economics alone requires that his horses perform extremely well in competition to earn back their high value. His training methods, plainly, are not the result of vague notions about kindness to animals, though Greg would never be anything but kind and respectful of them. As proven against the toughest competition, his methods are both the best and the kindest. I once saw something at his ranch that thrilled me. "Monty," he said, "come and have a look at my new babies." 5 handlers led the young horses in from the field without so much as pulling on their lead ropes. The horses were then saddled up and the riders carefully mounted. On the track, the gates were closed, but the horses were otherwise free to wander. A 6th person on an experienced saddle horse carried a long wand with a plastic flag at the end, used, if needed, to keep horses from endangering one another. "During the first 20 days of riding," said Greg, "we allow them to do whatever they want. There's no tension on the reins whatsoever." If a horse wanted to graze along the fence line, to canter, simply stand, or even lie down and roll, that was all fine. To grant this last wish, the rider dismounted and watched, unconcerned. I marveled at the correct thinking behind this approach. The horses were learning to carry the rider's weight and had no suspicion that they might ever be punished for anything. There was no chance to cultivate resentment or aggressive tendencies toward their human partners. The success of these methods and others outlined in this book point to a new beginning in the relationship between man and horse, and it has been my privilege to make a contribution to this spirit of understanding. In England recently, I received an invitation to meet with the Queen to bring her up to date on my work and to discuss views on the world of horses in general. Corporal Major Terry Pendry drove me through the now familiar grounds of Windsor Castle.
"You'll be meeting Her Majesty outside," he said, as he briefed me for the upcoming meeting.
"Outside? Are we going to stroll around the grounds together, or meet in the mews and look over some of her horses?" Terry parked to one side of the lawn that sweeps down in front of the castle. In the middle of this huge expanse of perfectly manicured green lawn sat a figure at a small table. A white cable snaked from the table to the castle and disappeared inside. I began the long trek over the lawn, and as I drew near, I recognized Her Majesty sitting there. The corners of the snowy white tablecloth flapped idly in the breeze. The bone china and silverware stood ready for our tea. The Queen greeted me in a very informal way, and I sat down at the table. She poured tea from a pot attached to that long white cord. We enjoyed finger sandwiches and tea as we began to talk. It was a perfect occasion in a perfect setting. We talked about horses, and once again she proved to be an interesting and informed owner. I felt thoroughly privileged to have met this woman whom history has placed in a unique position. I brought her up to date on the course offered at West Oxfordshire College under the directorship of Kelly Marks. The course offers my training methods. The first time that a course of this nature has been specifically designed and built into the curriculum. I told her of my recent experiences over starting gates. I said I looked forward to the future, when students of my methodology would advance to such an extent that my current practices would be dismissed as archaic. Even as I write the man who listens to horses, veterinarians are developing the ability to listen to horses to determine which part of the animal's gut hurts, the duodenum loop, the small or the large intestine. Long after the tea party was scheduled to end, the Queen and I rose to our feet. Our parting was genuinely warm. I had a vision of what this scene would look like from the ramparts of the castle. The white square of the table amid the green expanse of lawn. The remains of our tea. The chairs askew. The Queen of England strolling in the direction of the castle and heading toward a parked car. The California cowboy shaking his head in disbelief at the curious circumstances in which he found himself. Nearly 800 years ago, a very different ruler, a conqueror named Temujin, had a very different attitude to horses. His Mongol Empire grew to encompass the shores of the Pacific and the northern stretches of the Black Sea. Standing astride a quarter of the world's surface, he changed his name to Genghis Khan, meaning Master of All. Deservedly, that name now conjures unimaginable cruelty, an iron will, and an inflexible resolve. His chief ally in the remarkable expansion of his power and influence was the horse. Using ropes and whips, Genghis Khan harnessed the horse's strength, stamina, and speed. Like many who profess to love the horse, and do love the horse, the Mongols broke their young horses in the cruel, conventional way. They cherished the string of horses they took to war, but inevitably some were ridden to death. Horses had no answer to the Khan's cruelty, had no voice. But they did have a language. No one saw it, no one tried to see it. But that language has probably existed for 45 million years, virtually unchanged. We should put this into perspective. Humankind has been on this planet for only a few hundred thousand years, and already human language is fragmented into thousands of different tongues. The absence of communication between human and horse has led to a disastrous history of cruelty and abuse. As a result, we didn't gain the willing cooperation of the horse nearly as much as we might have done. Our loss has been considerable. The emotional connection with the horse has been diminished, but so has the performance and work we might have gained. It's a balance I've tried to redress during a lifetime's work with horses. Happily, that work continues. Appendix. Join Up, a step-by-step guide. The man who listens to horses sets out to tell the reader something of my life and how my ideas on starting horses were shaped. This appendix constitutes the how-to section of the book. It should be plain that starting horses gently is easy, efficient, and systematic. It's freely available to anyone with a positive attitude who's not frightened of horses. The first requirement is that you discard all preconceived notions about starting the young horse. Do retain, however, all your experiences with the horse that have taught you not to fear him and that enable you to move around him safely and effectively. Hold in your mind the idea that the horse can do no wrong, that any action taken by the horse, especially the young unstarted horse, was most likely influenced by you. We can do little to teach the horse. We can only create an environment in which he can learn. Likewise with people. The student who has knowledge pushed into his brain learns little, but he can absorb a great deal when he chooses to learn. Actions speak louder than words. We say it, but too rarely live by it. The horse uses a predictable, discernible, and effective language, one that requires no interpreters. Like any form of communication, equus, as I call it, requires some effort to master. If we refuse to believe that the horse can communicate, pain can be used to train him somewhat effectively. But pain is needless and terribly limiting. What if, on your first day of school, your teacher put a chain through your mouth or over your nose, gave it a jerk, and then took a whip to you when you tried to get away? What would your relationship with that teacher be like? How would you view school from that point on? While the horse's brain is not as complex as the human's, our response to cruelty is similar. The point of my method is to create a relationship based on trust and confidence. Most conventionally started horses form an adversarial relationship with the humans who employ them. If they agree to perform, it's with a reluctant attitude. The first rule of starting a fresh horse, then, is no pain. You, the trainer, will not hit, kick, jerk, pull, tie, or restrain. If you're forced to use some restraint, it should be of the mildest nature and without the feeling of "you must" communicated to the horse. Suggest to the horse that you would rather he did, but not that he must. The horse is the quintessential flight animal. When pressure is applied to the relationship, he'll almost always choose to leave rather than fight. The phenomenon that I call advance and retreat is evident throughout the animal kingdom, between animals of the same and different species, and even between humans. Consider, for example, the 14-year-old boy in high school who's attracted to a girl in his class and follows her incessantly. She wants nothing to do with him. He may persist for several months and then give up. Only at this point does she show interest. Advance, retreat. It's a useful tool in both human and equine psychology. In starting the young horse, I never use the term breaking. The intention is to cause this animal to accept without trauma the saddle, bridle, and rider. In my demonstrations, we accomplished that in about 30 minutes. I am suggesting, however, that with completely green horses, it's best before the starting procedure to take a few days to accustom them to the bit and to a small measure of communication through long lines in the mouth of the horse. In starting the horse, the aim is to achieve a number of related aims. You want to join up with the horse and convince the horse to follow you. You want to be able to touch his vulnerable areas and pick up his feet. You want to put on him saddle pad, saddle, bit, and bridle. Attach long lines. Get the rider on. Move a full circle right, one step back, a full circle left, and again one step back. You'll need the following equipment. 2 long lines, 30 feet long. 1 snaffle bit, fully equipped. 1 saddle, your preference. 1 saddle pad. 1 stirrup leather. A halter on the horse. I use a round pen in my operation, and while not absolutely necessary, it does make the job easier. My pen is 50 feet in diameter, 16 meters, with a solid wall 8 feet high, 2.4 meters, and roofed over. Its sand surface has a 2-inch cushion. I have, however, started horses in the wild with no fences, riding a horse to aid in travel. A square pen can be used, but it's much better if you can panel the corners out. 50 feet in diameter is optimum for mid-sized horses. Good footing is important for the safety of horses and people. Bring the horse, with his halter on, into the pen and have with you 1 long line, preferably a light sash 30 feet long, 9 meters. Stand near the center of the pen and introduce yourself by rubbing with the flat of your hand, no padding, the horse's forehead, even if you are already acquainted. Now move away and toward the rear of the horse, staying out of the kick zone. When you're behind the animal, or when he flees, whichever comes first, pitch the line toward his rear quarters. This light sash, long line, cannot hurt him in any way. At this point, almost all young horses will take flight and proceed around the pen. The horse is retreating, so you must advance. Keep the pressure on. Pitch the line about 2 times per revolution, or whatever it takes to keep your subject retreating. Maintain an aggressive mode. Your eyes drilled on his eyes. Your shoulder axis square with his head. Maintain forward movement as much as possible, but don't enter his kick zone. Try to get the horse to canter 5 or 6 revolutions one way, then reverse and repeat, except that this time you're readying the horse for a message. Would he like to stop all this work? Particularly watch the inside ear, the ear that is closest to you in the center of the pen. That ear will slow up in its movement or stop moving altogether, while the outside ear will continue to monitor his surroundings. The head will begin to tip, ears to inside, and the neck will bend slightly to bring the head closer to the center of the circle. He'll probably lick and chew, running his tongue outside the mouth. Finally, he should crane his head down near the ground. The ear gives you respect. Coming closer means just that. Licking and chewing says, "I'm a flight animal, and I'm eating so I can't fear you." Craning the head down means, "If we could have a meeting to renegotiate, I'd let you be the chairman." Experience will sharpen your senses to this communication, but essentially when you observe the horse in this mode, he's asking you to take the pressure off. He wants to stop. Now coil the line and assume a submissive mode, with your eyes down. Don't look at his eyes. Bring your shoulder axis to a 45-degree position. This is an invitation for him to come to you, or at least look your way and stop retreating. If he will come to you, this is good. If he stands and faces you but doesn't move forward, then start to move closer to him. But do it in arcs or semicircles, not straight at him. If he leaves you, put him back to work for a few more laps. Then repeat the process. As you move closer, do it with your shoulder axis at 45-degree angles to his body axis. For the most part, show your back to him. He should voluntarily move toward you and reach out with his nose to your shoulders. This is join-up. When you can approach his head, give him a good rub between the eyes and then walk away, moving in circles. I like to start by circling on the right hand about 10 feet in diameter. After the right is accomplished, circle left and repeat several times. He should follow you or at least move to maintain his head in your direction. This I call follow-up. If he doesn't follow you, then you'll find yourself facing his rear and you should put him back to work. Again, stay clear of the kick zone. Once follow-up is evident, the horse should follow you to the center of the pen and stand comfortably for the next step, which is to enter his vulnerable areas. Starting on the near side, the side you mount and dismount on, use both hands to massage neck, withers, back, hips, foreflanks, and rear flanks. Once you've done the same on the offside, you're ready to pick up the feet. Do this using the normal safe procedures. You're now ready to bring the balance of your equipment into the pen and place it on the ground near the